Chapter 28. Beware the Serpent. Narthani Headquarters, Predi City. Okan Akuyan stood next to Admiral Morfred Kalkin and Assessor Sadak Hizair, watching the sloop clear the breakwater and catch the wind past the harbor.
"There we go, Sadak," said Akuyan, addressing Hizair. "Now, if the messages to your agents just get there without detection, we should have all their acknowledgments in 5 or 6 days."
Akuyan had let his hair grow longer than usual, and it billowed from the wind gusts.
"I think the orders will jolt your agents when they get them."
"Certainly, from the delivery method," said Hizair. "They're aware they might be called on for direct action if necessary."
Hizair held his hat on with both hands to keep the wind from sending it flying. He appeared satisfied with seeing the sloop off.
"After this, we'll have the 3 strike teams launched in 2 6-days, once we have the date set for all 3 provinces.
Kalkin clasped his hands behind his back as he watched his sloop turn and head along the coast.
"Sadak, will you still consider this a success if you kill only one of the 3 hetmen?
Hizair shrugged, never losing his grip on his hat. "Strictly speaking, I could count a success if none of the teams are successful. The main point is to focus the clan's attention on protecting their own people and territory, so they don't get ambitious about what to do about us here in Predi. The one exception is the Keelan Hetman. He's proving too successful in rousing the other Hetman to action and cooperation. If we get only one of them, I hope it's him."
2 6-days until 2 of the strike teams land at dusk. Then the assault force on Swavebroke hit shore at first light the next morning, recited Akuyan, more to himself than to the other 2 men.
"Ivax was right to suggest starting the Swavebroke attack at dawn. Word by semaphore the Hetman strikes won't have come yet and alerted Swavebroke."
Brigadier Ivax Zelfa, commander of Narthani ground forces on Cadellium, had pointed out the impracticality of landing 2,500 men in the dark and expecting to coordinate it with the attack on Shulik, the Swavebroke capital. First light would be best, and by first light, Zelfa meant, the lead units would be on the docks of Shulik before enough light existed to read large lettering. The local agent had reported that Swavebroke hadn't implemented regular patrols along the coast or lookouts at strategic points. The Shulik harbor piers were empty of ships, since the Narthani naval blockade kept trading ships away. The Narthani intended to sail straight into the harbor and use the Swavebroker's own piers. They should be able to approach almost to the docks before being spotted, because the 2 Onyarian moons would have already set. Since no semaphore message could go out until there was light enough to read flags from however many miles distance lay to the next station, alerts from the Hetman attacks would not reach Swavebroke until the 2,500 men, 200 horses, and 20 12-pounder cannon were ashore. The 3 men watched another 5 minutes, each with thoughts about the coming operation, their roles, and the consequences if anything went wrong. When the sloop, now almost a mile offshore, disappeared behind a headland, Akuyan finally pushed his hair out of his eyes.
"Good. Now back indoors for me and the endless stack of papers."
"I'm afraid you're looking at the wrong man if you want sympathy, Okan," said Hizair. "I'll admit that while my stack might be more interesting than yours, it's still a stack that never gets smaller."
"That's the trouble with you groundwalker leaders," said Kalkin, laughing as the men turned toward the headquarter buildings. "You're too in love with pieces of paper."
"As if you don't have your own to do," said Akuyan, amused at the incorrigibly cheerful naval officer.
"Oh, I do. But that's what a flag lieutenant is for. The good ones, anyway. And mine is very good. Especially once he understands what I really need to see and what he can do himself, with occasional perusals by me."
"I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that, Morfred," Otherwise, I'd be shocked to think any Nathani officer did not understand the importance of properly completed paperwork.
Oh, but I do appreciate it, General. That's why my selection of flag lieutenants is so important.
As long as everything is done to proper standards, cautioned Akuyan. Amusement at the Nathani bureaucracy was one thing. But none of Akuyan's subordinates doubted that their commander expected the paperwork to pass any inspection. Akuyan Villa, Pretty City.
Orkan, how did you feel seeing the sloop off and the assassination plans going forward?
Rabia Akuyan already knew what her husband thought. She'd waited until they finished evening meal and the two children with them on Cadellium, their son Ozum, and his twin sister Lufta left them alone at the table. Knowing something is necessary to a mission is one thing, but liking it is different. No matter how many times I tell myself that killing one man by stealth is no different than ordering men to the deaths in a battle, it still makes me uneasy. Neither does the logical assessment of expected casualties seem to change things. The three headman attempts may result in 50 to 100 deaths. Cadelli and our men. The attack on Swavebrook will certainly cost many times that number. But my mind lingers more on the assassinations than on the Swavebrook attack.
You've said many times that a commander needs to balance the short and long term.
Now, dear, it's not appropriate for you to use my own words against me. They laughed. And Akuyan poured himself another glass of wine and a half glass for his wife. He knew, without asking how much more she would drink at this point in the evening. But yes, you're right, and so am I. The island will come into the Empire. It was never explicitly told to me, but I can read the signs. The High Command is firmly committed. My task is to accomplish this. And I hope to do it with the least destruction of properties and lives as possible. But it will happen. And the longer it takes, the more lives and property will be lost. We may be in a holding position since the Moreland setback, but one way or another, the basic mission stays the same. I've determined we can't subjugate the island with the forces we have. So it's wait to hear from home. Until then, I need to keep the clans focused on their individual security and on keeping their men close at hand. If that takes the lives of several hundred or even thousands of people, then that has to happen. If the clans launched all-out attacks on us, the number of lives lost, theirs, our troops, and especially Nathani civilians, not all of whom could we keep safe, would be far higher than attacking Swavebrook and the strikes against Three Headmen.
You believe what you've planned is the best way forward?
That, dearest, is one of the dirtiest secrets never fully explained to young officers. You never know if any decision is the right one.
Port of Salford, Keelan Province. Gethin Driftwich was not a happy man. Spying for the Nathani at the behest of his Nivax headman had been exciting, and the monthly pay amounted to more than he could earn in a year back at home. Not that he saw the coin himself, because it went to his family in Nivax. Neither did he see himself in particular danger. After all, he only passed on simple messages once or twice a month to Nathani sloops on scheduled patrols along the Cadellium coast. No one noticed him in the secluded, hidden location he'd picked out to send lantern codes to the sloop. He would never know that after the Keelanders caught the Abersford agent, an alert went out to look for other spies sending encoded messages by lanterns to Nathani ships. He hadn't been caught solely because the spot he'd chosen recessed into a cliff enough that the small boats watching a few hundred yards offshore couldn't see his light. Until now, sending the messages had been routine. Tonight,
all of that changed. After arriving at a signaling location, he was halfway through the time it took him to send light codes when he nearly had a heart attack. Three armed men appeared behind him and threw him to the ground, jamming cold steel against his throat. Under the light of both Onyarian moons and the stars, he glanced down and saw the blade of an impossibly large knife under his chin.
"Your name,"
hissed a pretty accented voice. His throat constricted, and he croaked a staccato of sounds, his knees lifeless and his whole body trembling.
"Your name,"
came the voice again, even harsher, and he felt the blade break the skin on his throat.
"Driftwitch! Driftwitch! Driftwitch! Gethin Driftwitch," he said.
The steel withdrew, and he sucked in the best breath he had ever taken. The man with the knife turned to the other two and said something that sounded like Narthani. The man released him, and he fell to the ground, only to be picked back up by the same man. The man unsealed a watertight pouch and pulled out a package.
"We're here to deliver a message. This package goes to your contact in Kernford. You are not to open it. The contact will tell you anything you need to know. You will be back here in 5 days to signal whether the package was received and the message inside acknowledged. Are there any questions?"
"Questions?" Driftwitch thought hysterically to himself. "Why would there be any questions? I'm risking being shot for spying for the Narthani when three men put a knife to my throat and then give me a package. Why would I have any questions?"
I'm to give this to my contact in Kernford," he said, trembling.
"And?" prompted the voice.
"And what was it?" "Oh, I'm not to open the package. The agent will tell me anything I need to know."
"Where's the report you were sending?" the man said.
"It sits here somewhere," said Driftwitch, waving toward the ground.
One of the men partly lifted the flap on the unblackened side of the lantern used to signal and swept the ground. He grunted and picked up three sheets of paper, now crumpled and smeared with footprints. The men exchanged more unintelligible words. The pretty officer put the sheets into the pouch from which he'd taken the package now held by Driftwitch's death grip.
"Your report is complete. Leave and deliver the package as you're told."
The man said nothing more to Driftwitch, uttered a short phrase in Narthani to the other men, and as quickly as they had appeared, the men vanished. Driftwitch didn't see where they went, nor could he hear their movement. They were just gone. He collapsed to the ground, scraping his hand against the rough rock face that provided one side of his signaling post. It took him 15 minutes to gather himself enough to walk back to where he had tied his horse, borrowed from the stables of his employer. The transport business had been almost non-existent since the blockade, and the Salford port had been dying for several years as workers and their families left, searching for work elsewhere on Cadellium. The elderly owner left the near-defunct business's details to Driftwitch, who remained the only full-time worker of the original 11. Thus he had access to wagons and the horses not yet sold. He made a point of driving a wagon to Kernford twice a month, every 3 6 days, to maintain an observable routine, even when the wagon remained near empty of cargo. His real purpose was to meet the Kernford agent, whose name he didn't know and didn't want to know. He rode back to the stables outside Salford, restabled the horse, and collapsed on his cot in his quarters, attached to a tack room. He lit a single candle and looked at the small package, though he wondered what was so important that the Narthani risked making physical contact. It never occurred to him to open the package. He had just returned from Kernford 3 days ago and was not scheduled to leave again for 14 days. Nevertheless, his instructions were to be back in Salford in 5 days
to signal a sloop the message had been received. He would have to leave first thing the next morning. Keelan Manor, Kernford. Esil Havant trotted his horse down the lane to Keelan Manor. He'd been here more times than he could count, but each time he scanned for details of any changes since his last visit, even if only the day before. The grounds were well maintained, the house impressive. He often imagined himself owning such an estate, though with a more modest-sized house. He'd had such imaginings during the many years he'd worked for Sadaki's heir. This wasn't the first time he'd served as a spy among enemies, but, to his surprise, he found that he felt comfortable among the Cadeli. He hoped they didn't have to destroy too much of the island, because he'd begun to think it might be his ultimate destination when his days of working for Hizair ended. He had become used to the moderate temperatures and the air freshened by sea and vegetation, much different than the bone-dry air and alternating cold nights and scorching days of his native central Narthon. As he neared the manor, he pictured his house on these grounds. But no, he wanted to be nearer the sea. Maybe similar grounds near Salford, with the sea within sight of the house, but not too close, so that he had to contend with salt spray. Yes, to always have the endless water within sight, so different from endless arid wastelands. He reached the manor and tied his horse on a rail in front of the veranda. He'd hardly put a foot on the first step when the manor door opened and a girl came out. She wasn't quite a young woman yet, but showed the budding signs of it. "A pleasant morning to you, Sir Merritt," greeted the friendly semaphore messenger.
"Hello, Esil. And yes, it's a fine morning. I saw you coming from my bedroom window. Father is just dressing. Is there an urgent message you need to get to him right away?"
"Now, Sir Merritt, you must be aware the semaphore messages are confidential. We at the station know what's in them since we receive and send, but besides us, only the recipient can know the contents."
Merritt wasn't fooled. She and Esil had had this exchange many times. They played this game regularly.
"But no," said Havant. "I can say that the message isn't urgent, so I can wait for the headman." "Oh, Sir Havant, who knows how long Father will take to dress? And I'm sure you haven't eaten yet this morning," said Merritt, taking on the tone of the innocent fair maiden. "I would be happy to show you the kitchen, where we can find you some fine food. Of course, I'd have to hold the message for Father so you can eat properly."
"Sir Merritt, I'm shocked that you'd think to bribe me to hand over the message I'm bound to give it only to the hand of the headman. Shocked!" Merritt giggled, and Avant's outrage morphed into avuncular fondness.
"Now, I might overlook this attempt if you were to lead me to this kitchen you mention."
Merritt put a hand to her chest.
"Now I'm the one shocked by your attempt at blackmail."
The ritual satisfied, Merritt grabbed Havant's hand and pulled him into the manor.
"Father will be down in a few minutes, so let's get you a couple of the fresh biscuits. I smelled them when I ran to greet you. I want to hear about that young lady you mentioned meeting, the one with the old rose accent.
And you can update me on the new litter of puppies you were so eager to see born," said Avant.
10 minutes and two biscuits later, Headman Keelan entered the kitchen, greeted Avant familiarly, then took and read the message. "If you don't have other urgent messages to deliver, Esil, could you wait while I compose a reply? I'll probably take 20 minutes or so."
"Of course, Headman. I'll wait here with Sam Merritt, with your permission. She advises me that it takes at least 3 biscuits to fully judge if they were made properly."
Cullet smiled.
"A wise plan. I'll also begin my own assessment.
He picked two of the still hot biscuits off the oven top and left the room. Before Merritt launched into the puppy report or asked about Havant's supposed new acquaintance, he had other topics in mind.
Sam Merritt, I noticed last time I was here that Sam Mera is back living here, and I assume the baby is the headman's new and first grandchild?
Yes,
said Merritt. She and Yosef stayed here while their new house was being built. It's only a half mile from here, and they just moved in.
So they've moved from Abersford? I know Sir Kolsko has his shops in Abersford, so I'm surprised they would move here.
Merritt grabbed a biscuit for herself and, with a mouthful, began a detailed explanation of why Yosef Kolsko moved to Kernford, so he could expand weapons production and become more involved in plans against the hated Narthani.
They don't know what they're dealing with, those shit-eating Narthani,
said Merritt, then looked around to see if her mother was around to chastise her language choice. When she confirmed the coast was clear, she continued.
Yosef will try to tell you he wasn't a hero at St. Citron's Abbey when the Baldorians attacked it. But I know better. I've talked with men who were there, and they assure me it was Yosef who saved the abbey.
And when the Narthani invaded Moreland, wasn't it Yosef's artillery and plans that won the day?
I mean, really? If he's not a hero, then who is? That scar on his head and the one on his leg, you know, the one you see only if he's swimming or something, do people think he got those at the dinner table?
Havant's casual interest in Yosef Kolsko changed to alarmed interest as Merritt recounted more details about her brother-in-law. His interest in the manor layout long forgotten, he led the youngest Keelan daughter on for more details before her father arrived, which he did just as Merritt was about to recall overhearing Yosef tell Mera about something called a balloon and how, if he could get it to work, it would allow clan fighters to see Narthani troop formations while still miles away.
Ah, Esil, thanks for waiting. Here's the return message, said Kulloch, as he walked in the kitchen. I'm sure you have other messages to deliver.
No, he doesn't, Merritt said.
Actually, Havant said hurriedly, so as not to give the Keelan leader any reason to question his lingering. I do need to get back to the station in Kernford. I'm sure other messages have come in, and I'm due for my time up on the scaffold changing panels at mid-morning.
Merritt will see you out then.
Havant let the girl see him to the front door of the manor and gave her a friendly, playful farewell. Well, he later hoped it had come across that way, because his mind kept racing in other directions.
But Great Noth, was everything the silly girl said true? If it was, how had he missed it? No, that wasn't fair. He'd read many of the semaphore messages to and from Hetman Keelan and other leaders, though not all. There had been little mention of this Kolsko. Who knew what could have been in other messages? And there had been no reason for him to question people about Kolsko. Until now, anyway. That had just changed. He'd talked to many of the Keelan men at Moreland City, but from what he heard, most of them had not been involved with the artillery or the direct attack on the Narthani infantry. He had to immediately seek out anyone from Abersford. The Keelan girl said many workers and their families already had or would move from Abersford to Kernford. He had to find them and learn more about this Kolsko. Havant waited until his horse had trotted out of sight of the Keelan manor before spurring it to a gallop. Not that he saved much time in getting back to Kernford, but the unconscious act matched his urgent need to get more information. Kernford, Central Plaza. The morning prayer service at St. Thomas Cathedral had ended a few minutes earlier, when Havant crossed the Kernford Central Plaza. The attendees usually numbered around 200, and now they mingled with the citizens of Kernford out to shop,
Workers going to and fro, and a group of men replacing broken paving bricks. His mind still obsessed over the visit to Keelan Manor and the alarming new information about Josef Kolsko, when he passed the great hall of the Keelans and turned down a street, then left to a lane of shops. He took the same route any time he traveled in the vicinity of the plaza, even if in the opposite direction of his destination, which in this case was the semaphore station on the other side of the city. His mind remained so unusually distracted that he almost missed the single 2-inch-long chalk mark on one specific brick sitting among thousands that made up the outer wall of a 2-story building. The mark, 6 feet off the ground, appeared there only when Geth and Driftwich was in the city and waiting for him at their prearranged rendezvous site. Havant had passed within 200 yards of it on his way back from the manor. Havant froze when he saw the mark, then recovered, looked around for anyone watching, and erased the mark. Driftwich was not due for his twice-monthly trips to Kernford for more than a 6-day, so Havant had not expected the signal. "What's the miserable little Nivaxian doing here now?" Havant wondered. He detested Driftwich, though he tried to keep the opinion from being obvious whenever they met. It was unprofessional and stupid to do otherwise, because Avant's assignment depended on the other agent serving as a go-between to the sloops and his heir back in Pretty City. Avant circled a block instead of turning around to avoid anyone noticing his change of direction. It was a small thing, but accomplishing this assignment and even his very life depended on a myriad of small things to keep suspicion from falling on him. It took him 20 minutes to retrace his path to the outskirts of Kernford and then take a smaller road that passed a patch of hawthistle bushes. The plants dropped leaves that crackled when dead, even after a rain. It was impossible to move through such patches without announcing your movements to anyone within 100 yards. Havant had picked this spot so that he and Driftwich could both check for anyone in a small clearing and hear another person approaching. He passed a wagon with its 2 horses tied to a tree, their feet hobbled. Down a narrow path to the clearing, he found the Nivaxian pacing nervously back and forth. Havant put on an expression of camaraderie. "Driftwich, you're not due. What's up?"
"I'll tell you what's up. I almost shit myself 2 nights ago when I was sending the latest report. Out of nowhere, there's 3 men dressed all in black and me with a knife big enough to gut a steer at my throat. They were from the sloop, I assume. I mean, where else would they be from? One of them spoke Cadelli with a pretty accent, but he spoke Narthani to the other two. All they said was to see you get this."
Driftwich held out a small square package, still tightly wrapped. Havant snatched the package from Driftwich and used the 3-inch blade he kept in his boot to slit the wrapping. Inside was another layer of wrapping, the second layer made of resin-impregnated gingko cloth. When the stalks of the gingko plant were soaked in lye, the released fibers could be used to weave cloth with such a tight thread count as to be almost waterproof. Further treatment with the tree resin finished the waterproofing, and the resin made the cloth self-sticking to complete the sealing of the contents. A third layer consisted of ordinary paper that stuck to the gingko cloth on one side, next to a message. Avant unfolded 2 sheets of paper and glanced over the contents. He read them again, slowly, as he decoded. He had the cipher memorized and could read the underlying message without resorting to quill and paper. Driftwich stood rocking on his feet, waiting to hear what was so important to break security protocol and bring Narthani on shore to deliver whatever had been written on the well-wrapped sheets. During the third reading, Havant spoke aloud softly, more to himself than to Driftwich.
"Well, well, well. Things are about to get interesting."
Driftwich didn't like the sound of that. Boring was more to his liking. Finally, Havant looked up at his nervous colleague. Driftwitch didn't need all of the details. In fact, it was best if he knew as little as possible.
Gethin, there are two things you need to do. First is to return to Salford and signal that I received the package as instructed.
Do you have anything to write on?
No.
When we leave, we'll go first to your wagon and I'll carve 5 numbers on the side of the wagon bed. When you send the message, include those 5 numbers at the beginning and end of the message. That will authenticate that I've received the package and understand the contents. The second thing you need to do is have 2 wagons ready exactly 9 days from now. They have to be large enough to hide 10 men each under some form of concealment. Perhaps straw would work, since air can get inside. I'll meet you at your employer's stable at sundown of that day. The 2 of us will drive the wagons to Kernford, so you should arrange to be gone 4 to 5 days without arousing suspicions.
20 men?
What men? And what will they be doing in Kernford?
Asked Driftwitch.
You'll get more information when it's necessary. For now, focus on your 2 tasks, getting back to Salford to send the acknowledgement message and getting the wagons ready 9 days from now.
Exactly.
But, well, all right.
The Nivaxian wanted more information, but he didn't expect to get it from Havant.
20 men,
stated Driftwitch.
How quickly do we need to get to Kernford? Making the trip in 1 hard day would require changing horses at least once. I assume you want to remain as unobtrusive as possible.
2 days,
said Avant.
The first night we'll travel until near dawn, then move off the road to a secluded spot and camp for the day.
We'll make it the rest of the way the next night.
I'll find a place near Kernford for the men while they wait. You will stay at the inn you usually use.
Put in the wagons enough food and water for the 22 of us for 4 days.
Come to think of it, I'll come to Salford a day early to see that everything is ready with the wagons.
Driftwitch licked his lips, and he felt the hairs on his arm stand up. Whatever the Narthani had planned, he knew he wouldn't like it. For the last 6 months, he had a set of gear packed and ready for a quick exit from Keelan. He didn't know if he could make the 300-mile trip back to Nivax by sticking to mountainous terrain without being caught, but it was his emergency escape option should the worst happen. When he got back to Salford, he would check the gear and add saddlebags of food and water. He also decided to see about trading existing horses for 2 younger ones. Havant watched his colleague disappear, heading south back to Salford. He knew the man wasn't reliable enough for the situation, but he was all Havant had to work with. He couldn't be away from Kernford too long himself, so he'd have to trust that Driftwitch would do what he was told. Not that Havant thought the Nivaxian would tell anyone. He was too cowardly for that. More likely, he'd try to get back to Nivax, maybe hiding in the mountains and slowly working his way back. Even if that happened, Havant would get the wagons ready himself. At least 1 of the 20 men would surely be able to drive the 2nd wagon. Havant would be in Salford a day early, and the stable owner hardly ever visited the property, but with trade almost non-existent. As for the other few occasional workers, if Havant encountered them, he could either bluff his way through, or they would meet quick ends, not to be noticed until the operation was finished or underway.
Assassinating the Keelan headman, Havant thought to himself. Hizer is ratcheting up the stakes. I assume he knows what he's doing and that the chances of succeeding here can't be better than 1 in 2. Is this the only such action? Is he after other headmen too? Not that I need to know, for my part.
Havant understood the logic of targeting Cullet Keelan. The clan was far too strong and organized. However, headquarters likely remained unaware of the significance of Josef Kolsko. Hell, even he himself wasn't that aware until the Keelan girl clued him in.
She said Kolsko and the oldest Keelan daughter lived only a half mile away from the main manor. He wondered if they could hit them both the same night, thinking it definitely worth a try and that Hizair would approve if he had the same information Havant now had. He'd talk with the strike team leader and see whether they could agree to add Kolsko as a target. This assumed that a reasonable opportunity would present itself. And if they succeeded, what would that do to his position? Only Hizair and he knew that one of the code numbers at the end of the message was Hizair's signal to him that he could decide whether to stay in position or come out with the strike team. He'd have to think about that now, during, and after the assassination attempt.